Neither Sally, Pearly, nor Cal were aware of the drama that had played out at the saddle shop when they rolled into town later that morning. Big Rock was a busy place, with two trains at the depot, one passenger and one freight. The passenger train was taking on passengers for its run to the east, and even though the engineer was at rest, the fireman wasn't. He was working hard, stoking the fire to keep the steam pressure up. Two stagecoaches and a half dozen carriages were also sitting at the depot, either having just delivered or waiting for train passengers. Out in the street behind the depot, a horse-drawn streetcar rumbled by. This was what greeted Sally, Pearly, and Cal as the three of them came into town to buy supplies. Sally was driving a large wagon, and Pearly and Cal were mounted, but riding slowly to keep pace with the wagon.
Woo-wee, it sure is a busy place this morning.
It always gets busy when a train is here.
Miss Sally, you know what we ought to do? We ought to make arrangements with the railroad to carry the cattle up to Sorrento. That way we wouldn't have to drive them none.
My goodness, Pearly. Do you have any idea how many cars it would take to move 3,000 cattle?
No, I don't.
Well, if you could get 30 cows to a car, it would take 100 cars. That would be at least 5 trains. And because there is no track direct from here to Sorrento, the trains would have to go almost 1,000 miles to get there. That means it would take nearly as long to ship them by train as it would to drive them. And the shipping costs would eat up about a quarter of the gross.
How'd you come up with all that? You're awfully smart to figure out all that.
Maybe if you think about something other than eating all the time, you'd be able to come up with things like that, too.
What you talking about? You didn't know none of that stuff neither.
Yes, I did.
Did not.
I did, too.
Sally stopped the wagon, and the two young cowboys halted their horses. They sat in the middle of the street while traffic passed back and forth around them, paying little attention to them.
Boys, would you please stop arguing? I've got business to attend to, and you do as well. Ah, yes. Remember, Smoke wanted you to find some drovers who are willing to make the drive with us. You do understand that, don't you?
Yes, ma'am. We understand. It's just that we were wondering...
You were wondering what? What's wrong?
Well, Miss Sally, that seems to me like an awful big responsibility for me and Cal to handle. I mean, they're going to be working for Smoke. Seems like he should be hiring them. What if we don't get the right kind of men?
Pearly, you are going to be the foreman, and Cal, you are going to be right under him. Everyone we hire will be working for the two of you, just like they are working for Smoke and me. You've been around the Sugarloaf for a long time now. You know what kind of men will be good for the job.
But
nothing. Smoke has every confidence in the world in the two of you, and so do I. Now, go hire us some good men. You can do that, can't you?
Well, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am, I reckon we can do that. Right, Cal?
Yeah, we'll get men you and Smoke will be right proud of.
I know you will. When you've hired the men, come down to the general store. I should have the wagon loaded by then.
Yes, ma'am. Come on, Cal. Let's me and you go get us some cowboys.
Got any idea where we should start?
Not directly, but town's a busy place today. I'm sure we'll run into someone somewhere.
As the two cowboys rode down to the opposite end of town, they saw a fistfight in progress in the street in front of the livery. One of the combatants was a soldier in uniform. He was wearing sergeant stripes on his sleeves. The other combatant was a civilian. The civilian was much younger than the soldier, but he was nearly as big, and he was more than holding his own.
Boy, I'm gonna play with you for a bit. Then I'm gonna hurt you, and I'm gonna hurt you bad.
But Mike was proven to be a little more than the sergeant expected. The sergeant swung hard with a roundhouse right, but Mike, who was quick and agile, ducked under the swing, then countered with a left jab to the sergeant's nose.
Why, you snot-nosed kid! I'm gonna knock your block off!
He swung with another roundhouse right, missing again. This time, Mike caught him with a right hook to the chin. Mike scored with two more sharp jabs. It was now obvious that the sergeant was on his last legs. He was stumbling about, barely able to stay on his feet. Mike had set him up for the finishing blow when one of the soldiers who'd been supporting the sergeant suddenly grabbed the boy from behind. Pearly slid down from his horse, and before the sergeant could throw another punch, Pearly brought the butt of his pistol down on the head of the man who had grabbed Mike. With his arms now free, Mike was able to finish the fight with two more blows. With the fight over and nothing to hold the spectators' interest, the crowd broke up. Several of the soldiers dragged their beaten comrade away with them, leaving Mike standing in the middle of the street.
What was the fight about?
The soldier took some oats from Mr. Lambert's livery. When I told him he had to pay for them, he called me a liar. One thing led to another, and next thing you know, we was fighting.
Kennedy, you're fired!
A man came up behind them.
Mr. Lambert, that soldier was stealing oats from you.
He said he would.
He was. I seen him do it.
Well, that don't matter none anyway. What's a nickel's worth of oats? You get the army mad, we won't get none of their business. All for a nickel's worth of oats? It just ain't good business, boy. About the only way I can make up for it now is to fire you.
But Mr. Lambert, I need the job.
Sorry, boy, but business is business. Besides, this ain't the first time you've got into a fight. And I told you last time I wasn't going to put up with no more of it. You're fired!
Lambert turned and started striding purposefully back to the livery.
Pearly, what do you think?
I think yes.
What are you two talking about?
Well, you're going to be looking for another job, right?
Well, yeah, I reckon I will be.
How'd you like to come work for the Sugarloaf?
What? Are you serious?
Yes, I'm serious.
Do you think Mr. Jensen would hire me?
We're hiring you.
You?
We're fixing to drive a herd of cows up to Wyoming. Smoke's in us to town to hire some men. If you want the job, it's yours.
Oh, yes, sir, I want the job. You better believe I want it.
Good. Now we just need to find five more men.
Three.
A pair of soldiers who'd been watching the fight came up.
What you mean I only need three more?
My name is Andy Wilson. This here is Dooley Thomas. We'd be happy to come work for you if you have us.
I'm afraid not.
Why not? Well, we're good workers.
You're also in the army. I ain't gonna hire no deserters, and I know Smoke won't.
Well, if that's the only problem, then it ain't a problem.
And why isn't a problem?
Because we ain't deserters. Get your paper out, Dooley.
As Dooley pulled out a piece of paper from his back pocket, Andy did the same. He showed the paper to Pearly.
What is this?
These here is our discharge papers. Me and Dooley have done served our time, and we got ourselves mustered out this morning. We're still wearing uniforms because we ain't got no civilian clothes yet.
Pearly read both papers, and he looked at Andy.
According to this paper, you're from Cincinnati. And Dooley here is from Boston.
Yes, sir, that's right.
What you do before you come in the army?
Well, sir, I work down on the river docks, loading and unloading boats.
I worked in a factory making bricks.
A dock worker and a brick maker. There won't be much call for loading boats or making bricks during this drive.
Wasn't much call for loading boats or making bucks in the army either. But we both learned a soldier.
I need cowboys. Either of you know anything about cows?
They give milk?
Horses can give milk.
Well, I can't tell the difference between a cow and a horse.
Well, I'll give you credit for honesty. I reckon anyone who can learn how to soldier can learn how to cowboy. All right, you two go with Mike. Mike, get your tack and go down to the general store. Miss Sally is down there getting supplies. You can help her load the wagon.
Who's Miss Sally? How will we recognize her?
She's the boss's wife. And don't you worry none about recognizing her. She'll be about the prettiest woman in town. I know what she looks like.
Pearly and Cal watched as the three men walked down toward the general store.
You think they'll work out all right?
I don't know why not. Like I said, they learned how to soldier.
A couple of minutes later, Pearly and Cal tied their horses off in front of the Longmont Saloon and stepped inside.
Pearly, Cal?
Louis Longmont was behind the bar.
It's good to see you boys. Is Smoke with you today?
No, sir, Mr. Longmont. He's still out at the ranch.
Well, that's all right. You boys are always welcome, with or without Smoke. What'll it be?
Two beers.
And I'll have the same.
Longmont drew four mugs, then set them in front of the two boys.
Cal, wasn't that long ago you wasn't old enough to drink beer. I remember Miss Sally telling me what she'd do to me if she caught me serving you one.
I'm old enough now.
Yeah, that's why I put them in front of you. No way I'd go against Miss Sally otherwise. So, how are things going out at Sugarloaf?
We're looking to hire three good men.
Really? It's mid-fall. Most ranches lay off at the end of summer. What are you doing out at Sugarloaf that you need more men?
We're driving a herd up into Wyoming.
Oh, I see. So you're looking to hire someone next spring?
No, not in the spring. We want someone now.
Why would you want someone now? Why not wait until you actually drive the herd?
Because we're driving the herd up now.
What? It's late in the year? Well, that's crazy. Why would Smoke do something like that?
Because Miss Sally's got in her mind that we're going to have us another winter, kind of like the one we had a couple years back when there was that big freeze out. So we're selling off half the herd to the U.S. government so as they can provide beef for the engines. Only the government won't pay for the beef till we can deliver it to them.
Yeah, I guess I can see why you would want to drive a herd north. I guess my question now is, can you do it?
I think we can if we have good men with us. You said a lot of cowboys have been laid off for the winter, right?
Yeah.
Well, what about Billy Cantrell? He was riding for the Doubletree. He's a good man with cattle. I'd like to have him. You know if he was laid off.
He was laid off, all right. Well, I don't think he'll be making any trail drives with you.
Why not? Me and Billy has always got along, and I know that Smoke will match whatever he was getting over the Doubletree.
Yeah, well, Billy's in jail, and he's likely to be there until spring. Seems Billy got upset with a drummer from Denver. He didn't like the way the drummer was acting around Chris Candy.
What you mean the way he was acting around Chris Candy? Chris Candy's a whore. Billy can't get upset with every man who has anything to do with her. That's her job.
Well, it ain't her job to get her eye blackened, and that's what the drummer did.
Oh.
So Billy blackened both the drummer's eyes, and he broke the drummer's nose. If Sheriff Carson hadn't pulled him off when he did, why, like as not, Billy would have broken both the drummer's hands as well.
How long's he in jail for?
Well, the judge gave him 30 days or $30, and since Billy didn't have $30, he's serving the 30 days.
Well, you think Sheriff Carson would turn him over to us if we paid his fine?
I reckon he would, especially if he knew that Billy was going to be out of town and out of his hair for a while.
And then Smoke will pay his fine.
Hold on now, Pearly. Haven't we better take that up with Smoke first?
Didn't he say he'd trust us to get good men?
Well, yeah, but I...
But nothing. Billy's one of the best cowboys around. Everybody knows that. He's well worth paying off his fine to have him with him.
All right, if you think so.
Smoke don't like it, I'll take the responsibility. And I'll pay the fine myself.
Oh, no need for that. I'll back you on it with Smoke, and I'll pay half the fine.
Good. Now we only need two.
Pearly and Cal left Longmont's and went to go visit Billy in the jailhouse.
You don't need to go nowhere else.
Billy pointed to the two men in the cell next to him.
These here is the Buttram boys, Leroy and Hank. Hire them and you'll have everyone you need.
I can't just hire anybody. They need to have some skills.
I've punched cows with these boys for most of the past year. They're good hands, both of them.
Why are they in jail?
Well, because they... Truth to tell, I don't know why they're in jail. They was already here when Sheriff Carson brung me in. Hey, Leroy.
Both Buttrams were asleep, or appeared to be, as they were lying on their bunks with their hats pulled down over their eyes.
Leroy!
What do you want?
What for are you and Hank in jail?
For stealing back what was earned.
What do you mean, stealing back what was yours?
Do you know that low-ass pipsqueak named Josiah Pogue?
Yeah, he owns the leather goods shop. I don't know him well, but I know who he is.
He done some work for me, then he tried to charge too much. When I couldn't pay it, he took my saddle.
Well, that's not stealing. That's legal.
Yeah, well, what he done was put a fender on. When I couldn't pay for the fender, I took it off and gave it back to him, but that wasn't good enough. He wanted my whole saddle, so me and Hank took the saddle anyway.
Which is when the deputy showed up, and that's how we wound up in here.
If me and Cal can get this cleared up, would you two boys agree to work for Sugarloaf?
Yeah, we'll come work for Sugarloaf, won't we, Leroy?
Well, sure. It's better than being in here.
A little bell rang as the door to Pogue's leather goods store was opened.
I'll be right with you.
A moment later, a tall, bald-headed man appeared.
Yes, sir. Can I help you, gentlemen? You two men work for Mr. Smoke Jensen, don't you?
Yes.
He's a fine man. Are you perhaps looking for something for him?
Cal was looking at a belt, holding it up to examine the intricate scrolling in the leather.
That is a fine belt, if I do say so myself.
Ooh, yes, sir. It is pretty, all right.
I can make you a very good price for it.
No, sir. We ain't here to buy nothing.
Then why are you here?
We want to talk to you about the Buttram brothers.
No, them. They are brutish men, the two of them. I hope the sheriff sends them to prison. They need to learn that they can't just come in here and take what doesn't belong to them.
But the saddle did belong to them, didn't it? It was Leroy's saddle, I believe.
In a manner of speaking, it was his saddle. But I had a legitimate lien against it. And until that lien is satisfied, the saddle belongs to me.
Would it square things with you if the lien was paid off?
As far as not making a claim on the saddle, yes, it would. But I would still like to see them punished.
Why?
Why? Because they need to know that they can't just run roughshod over decent citizens. Besides, I'm a little frightened of them.
Suppose you were paid off the $10 and the Buttrams left town, so there'd be no possibility of them causing you any more trouble. Would that satisfy you?
Why are you so interested in what happens to the Buttrams?
Because Smoke is going to drive a herd of cows north, and we want to hire the Buttram boys to help us out. But we can as long as they're in jail.
How far north?
All the way to Wyoming.
Well, that's a long way to drive cattle.
Yep, and it should certainly be far enough away to keep the boys out of your hair.
What hair?
Yes, what hair indeed. All right, boys. If you see to it that I get my $10, I'll inform Sheriff Carson that I don't intend to press charges.
Thank you.
Pearlie pulled out his billfold, then extracted $10 and gave it to Pogue.
Thanks.
Pogue took a pencil and a piece of paper from a shelf and started writing.
I, Josiah Pogue, having been duly satisfied as to the debt owed me by the Buttram brothers, do hereby free them of any further financial obligations toward me, and relinquish any claim to the saddle belonging to Leroy Buttram. I also withdraw the charges I filed against them.
Are you sure you want to do this? I mean, have you really thought about what you're doing?
Sheriff Carson spoke with the pair a few minutes later as he released Billy, Hank, and Leroy to Pearlie and Cal.
I'm sure. I know Billy to be a good hand, and if he vouches for the other two, that's good enough for me.
I'm not talking about that. I know all three of those boys, and they probably will make you good hands. I'm talking about this foolishness of trying to drive a herd that far north at this time of year.
You know Smoke as well as anyone, Sheriff. If he says he can do it, I believe he can do it.
Well, I'll give you this. If any man alive can take a herd of... How many cows did you say it was?
3,000 head.
3,000 head? Well, like I was about to say, if any man alive can take a herd of 3,000 head all the way to Wyoming this late in the season, Smoke Jensen is that man. But I certainly don't envy any of you.
Hold it. What are you talking about? What do you mean taking 3,000 head of cattle to Wyoming? I thought you said we was coming to work at Sugarloaf.
That's right. And the work you're going to be doing is taking a herd to Wyoming.
When?
Now.
Now? Are you crazy? It's damn near winter.
That's why we need to get started right away.
You didn't say nothing about driving no herd north when you hired us. All you said was that you was looking for some more hands.
You want to go, I'm sure we can arrange for you to stay here in jail. I can always get someone else.
Yeah, well, you just...
No, you don't need anyone else. Don't pay my brother no never mind. Me and Leroy will do it.
The wagon was about half loaded by the time Pearlie, Cal, Billy, Hank, and Leroy arrived. Mike, Billy, and the Buttrams already knew each other, but Andy and Dooley had to introduce themselves. Pearlie noticed that both former soldiers were now wearing new jeans and plaid shirts.
Yeah, don't that look nice? Miss Sally bought them for us. First time I've had anything other than an army uniform on in 4 years.
Come on, boys. Let's get the wagon loaded so we can get back to the ranch in time for supper.
The village was typical of all the villages of the Plains Indians. The teepees were erected in a series of concentric circles with the openings facing east. They were pitched alongside a fast-flowing stream, which provided not only water for drinking, cooking, and washing, but also fresh fish. Although there were no addresses as such, everyone knew where everyone else lived by their position within the circles. Fall had already come. Bright yellow aspen trees stood out from the dark green conifers interspersed with a spattering of red and brown from the willow, oak, and maple that climbed the nearby mountainsides. Smoke curled from the tops of the lodges as the women prepared meals while the men watched over the herd of horses or worked at cleaning their rifles or making bows and arrows. Children played beside the water. The chief of the village was a man named Red Eagle. Red Eagle was once the great warrior chief of a proud people, but now he was a chief in name only. In compliance with the treaty signed with the soldiers, Red Eagle had moved his people onto a reservation. The reservation guaranteed peace with the soldiers, but it stripped his people of all identity and pride. Now they were totally dependent upon the white man for their very survival. They were not allowed to hunt buffalo, for to do so would require them to leave their designated area. But there were few buffalo anyway, the herds having been greatly diminished by the white men who had hunted to supply meat for the work crews that were building the railroads, or worse, the buffers who took only the hides and left the prairie strewn with rotting meat and bleaching bones. Red Eagle's people were dispirited. Without the buffalo, there was little to eat. They'd been promised a ration of beef by the agency, but the promised beef had not materialized. Even if it had, it was a poor substitute for the buffalo. Red Eagle didn't care much for beef, and he knew that his people felt as he did. But if it was a choice of beef or starvation, they would take the beef. Not everyone agreed with Red Eagle. There were some who wanted to leave the reservation, to be free to hunt what buffalo remained. But Red Eagle had no wish to see his village subjected to the kind of murderous attack he and his wife had lived through at White Antelope's village at Sand Creek. So he counseled his people to stay on the reservation. Sand Creek proved, however, that even obedience to the white man's law would not always protect you. There, Colonel John M. Chivington and his Colorado militia had murdered men, women, and children, even as the terrified Indians were gathering around a teepee flying the American flag. White Antelope, the head of the Sand Creek village, was Red Eagle's very good friend. An old man of 71, White Antelope was convinced that the soldiers were attacking because they didn't understand that his people were a peaceful band. In order to prove that his village was friendly, he raised the American flag over his teepee. Then, in order to reinforce his declaration of peace, he started walking toward Colonel Chivington, carrying a white flag. Despite White Antelope's efforts to show the soldiers that neither he nor his people represented a danger to the soldiers, he was shot down. Red Eagle had screamed out in anger and grief at seeing his friend murdered. That had been many years ago. Now, Red Eagle was the leader of his own village, and he was determined not to let his people be slaughtered, as had been the villagers under White Antelope's protection. If the soldiers demanded that Red Eagle keep his people on the reservation, then that is exactly what he would do. And if Walking Bear and the band of young firebrands who followed him wanted to make trouble off the reservation, then they would have to deal with the soldiers themselves, because he would not make counsel on their behalf. As the shadows of evening pushed away the last vestiges of color in the west, Red Eagle came out into the village circle to sit near the fire. The village circle acted as a community center for the village. It was an area of dry grass, smooth logs, and gentle rises, making it a very good sitting place. Every night that weather permitted, men, women, and children from the village would gather around the fire's light and talk of the events of the day. The village circle was a place where problems were discussed, group decisions made, and young men and young women could court under the watchful eyes of the village. It was also a place of entertainment, sometimes consisting of dancing, but often a place where stories were told. One of the reasons Red Eagle was a leader of the village was because he was an old man who had lived through many winters and had experienced a lot of adventures. That made him a particularly good storyteller when he was in the mood, and tonight he was in just such a mood. Besides, he thought, a good story would lift his people's spirits so that they would not think of the hunger that was gnawing at their bellies.
Listen, and I will tell you a story. Once there was a time before the people, before Kiowa, before Arapaho, before Comanche, before Lakota, even before Cheyenne. This was the time before time. This was in the time of the beginning, before the winter count, before there was dry land. Then there was only water and the Great Spirit, who floated on the water. With him were only things that could swim, like the fish and the swan, the goose and the duck. The Great Spirit wanted to have people, but to do that, had to make land to walk upon. So he asked someone to dive to the bottom. "Let me try," a little duck said. The swan laughed at the little duck. "You are much too small. I am a mighty swan, the most noble of all creatures. I will dive to the bottom and find earth." So the swan dove down through the water to try and find the earth. But when he came up, his bill was empty. "The water is much too deep," the swan said. "I could not find the bottom." "Let me try and find the bottom," the little duck said. But the goose laughed at the duck. "You are much too little and too weak to find the bottom. I am a goose. I am big and strong. I will find the bottom." So the goose took a deep breath and dove very deep. But he couldn't reach the bottom either. He came up, gasping for breath, and he said, "Great Spirit, I think you are playing tricks with us. I think there is no bottom. Please, let me try," the little duck said again. Both the swan and the goose laughed. "Foolish little duck," they said. "If we could not find the bottom, what makes you think you can?" "I believe I can do it," the little duck said again. "You may try," the Great Spirit said. The little duck took a deep breath and plunged down through the water. He was underwater for a long time, and everyone thought that the little duck had drowned, and they were very sad. "You should not have let him try," they said to the Great Spirit. But the Great Spirit told them to have patience. Then, when it seemed that all was lost, the little duck came back up with a bit of mud in its bill. "How could he do that when we could not?" the swan asked. "He is small, and we are big." "He is small, but his heart is big, and his soul is good. That gives him very strong medicine, and that is why he succeeded where you failed," the Great Spirit said. Then, taking the mud from the bill of the little duck, the Great Spirit worked it in his hands until it was dry, and with it, he made little piles of land on the water's surface. That land grew and grew until it made solid land everywhere.
Red Eagle held his arm out and took in all the land around him.
And that is what we see today. Then, two young men and two young women who were looking for food walked for 8 days and 8 nights without eating or drinking or sleeping. They saw a high peak and decided to go to it to die, for it would be a marker to show their burying place. But when they got there, they saw a yellow-haired woman who showed them the buffalo. The men hunted the buffalo and got food to eat, and the women bore many sons. The sons took many wives and bore more children. I am the child of one of those children, just as you are the children of my children. And thus, we are all Cheyenne.
Once Red Eagle finished his story, others began to tell stories as well. If the story was to be a tale of bravery in battle, the one who spoke would walk over to the lodge pole and strike it with his coup stick. Then everyone would know that he was going to tell a story of an enemy killed in battle. In such stories, the enemy warriors were always brave and skilled, because that made the warrior's own exploits all the greater. Not all stories were of enemies killed in battle. Some of the stories were of hunting exploits, and some told of things that had happened in the time of their father's father's father that had been handed down through the generations to be preserved as part of their history. One of those who spoke little, but of whom many tales were told, was Walking Bear. A few days earlier, Walking Bear had led a war party against a small establishment that consisted of a military stockade, a stagecoach station, and telegraph office. The stockade was manned by about 50 soldiers, and when Walking Bear tried a frontal attack against the soldiers, he was driven back by cannon fire and by the long-range fire of the soldiers' rifles. As the soldiers were protected by the heavy timbers of the stockade, Walking Bear was unable to dislodge them, even though he had superior numbers. Walking Bear tried a few ploys. He sent 10 warriors down toward the soldiers to act as decoys, but they were unable to draw the soldiers out. The next morning, he sent 20. This time, the soldiers came out as far as the bridge, but would come no farther. Some suggested the warriors should slip down at night and set fire to the stockade, but Walking Bear insisted that only cowards fight in such a way. They finally decided that they would try another frontal assault the next day, massing all their numbers. Before they could launch their attack, though, they were surprised to see an entire platoon of cavalrymen ride out of the fort, cross the bridge, then head westward at a trot. The soldiers had come out of the fort to provide an escort for an approaching wagon train. Elated at their good fortune, Walking Bear mounted all his warriors, and they swarmed down on the wagons and the escorting soldiers, killing many white men. When Walking Bear returned, he told the others in the council that the white men had been taught a lesson and would now obey the treaty they had signed.
No. I fear that all you have done is anger the white man so that we will get no beef.
You want beef? I will get beef for you. I will get all the beef you can eat.
How will you do such a thing?
Are you an old man that you have forgotten the way of our people? I will get beef the way Cheyenne have always gotten food. I will find it, and I will bring it back. I will not wait for the white man to give it to us, as if we are children, pawing and mewing to suckle at the teat.
Walking Bear's words were angry and disrespectful of an old man who had long ago earned the respect of all his people. Red Eagle stood up and pulled his robe about him.
Go. Leave our village before you bring evil to us.
And if I say I do not wish to go, what can you do? You can do nothing, old man. You are old and weak, and you have no medicine.
Red Eagle said nothing, but he raised his hand into the air, then made a circular motion with his fingers. A large eagle suddenly appeared, swooping down out of the darkness. He made a pass at Walking Bear's head, legs extended, claws bared. The eagle raked his claws across Walking Bear's face, leaving three parallel bleeding gashes on his cheek. Then, with a graceful but powerful beat of his wings, the eagle soared back up to disappear in the darkness. Walking Bear put his hand to his cheek, ran the fingers across the cuts, then held them out to look at the blood shining darkly in the firelight.
How?
Leave.
I will go. I am not going because you have ordered me to, but because I can no longer live with men who fear to walk the path of a warrior. Who will come with me?
About 24 young men stood up, standing silently in the night, their eyes shining red from the light of the fire. Red Eagle looked at all of the young men, and then nodded.
Do you see that the bravest of our people have joined me?
Go! Take your women and your children with you. You are no longer a part of this village.
As Walking Bear and those who followed him left the village, their departure was greeted with silence, partly in stunned disbelief over what they were witnessing, and partly in grief at losing members of their village.
I will say for the last time the name of Walking Bear, and the names of those who left us. Then, after this day, do not say their names again, for they are no more.
As Walking Bear and his warriors and their families moved away from Red Eagle's village, you could see the despair etched on his people's faces.
It is a grim day that the Great Spirit has given us.
Oye, 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 this here court is about to convene. The Honorable Judge Spencer Clark presiding.
The Honorable Spencer Clark came out of the back room of the saloon and took a seat at his bench, which was the best table in the saloon. The table sat upon a raised platform that had been built just for this purpose. The saloon was used as a court because it was the biggest building in town. An ancillary reason for holding court in the saloon was because it was always crowded, thus making it easy for the judge to impanel a jury by rounding up 12 sober men, good and true. If it was sometimes difficult to find 12 sober men, then the judge could stretch the definition of sobriety enough to meet the needs of the court. The good and true, however, had to be taken upon faith. Quince Pardeen had been charged with the murder of Sheriff John Logan. There was no question that he had killed Sheriff Logan, because he had done so on the main street of the town in front of no fewer than 30 witnesses. There was some question, however, as to whether or not it could actually be considered murder. That was because it was clear that Sheriff Logan drew his pistol first. The prosecution contended that the sheriff did so in the line of duty while attempting to arrest a man for whom there were wanted posters in obvious circulation. The city of Pohico had only two lawyers, David Varner and Bailey Gilmore, neither of whom was a prosecuting attorney. Because of that, Judge Clark brought the two men into his hotel room prior to the trial.
I don't suppose Pardeen has hired either of you to represent him, has he?
It is my understanding he is going to ask that a lawyer be appointed.
Do either of you volunteer for defense?
Varner and Gilmore looked at each other, but neither spoke.
Very well, flip a coin.
Varner called heads. It came up heads, and he asked to prosecute. That made Gilmore Pardeen's defense attorney. Gilmore was conscientious enough to believe in providing the best defense possible, regardless of the heinousness of the crime, and he set out to do just that. He made a very strong argument that Pardeen saw only the draw, and perceiving that his life was in danger, reacted as anyone would.
Pardeen might be a wanted man, but even wanted men do not surrender their right to self-preservation. I lament the fact that Sheriff Logan was killed, and for that, his dear widow has our sincerest sympathy.
Gilmore glanced over at Mrs. Logan, who, still wearing widow's weeds, lifted her black veil to dab at her eyes with a silk handkerchief.
Indeed, the entire town of Puxico has our sympathy, for Sheriff Logan was known far and wide as a good and decent man.
What the hell are you doing, lawyer? Whose side are you on anyhow?
Mr. Pardeen, one more outburst like that and I'll have you bound and gagged. You may continue your argument, counselor.
The defense attorney nodded, then brought his closing argument to its conclusion.
Gentlemen of the jury, any way you look at this fracas, no matter how good and decent a man Logan was, if you are fair and honest in your deliberation, you will agree that Mr. Pardeen acted in self-defense.
Varner waited until Gilmore had taken his seat before he rose to address the jury.
I applaud the esteemed counselor for the defense. He is a good man who believes that anyone, even a person as evil and as obviously guilty as Quince Pardeen, deserves a good defense. He chose, of course, the only option open to him. He chose to make his plea one of self-defense. But despite my esteemed colleague's most sincere attempt, the truth is...
Varner paused and looked directly at Pardeen.
Mr. Gilmore's noble effort was an exercise in futility. Quince Pardeen is a cold-blooded murderer. Many a good man has fallen before his gun, none finer than our own sheriff. By his lifetime of evil, Pardeen has forfeited forever any claim to self-defense.
After Varner sat down, Judge Clark instructed the jury that they withdraw to a room at the back of the saloon to make their decision. After only 5 minutes of deliberation, the jury sent word that they had reached a verdict. After retaking his seat at the bench, Judge Clark put on his glasses, slipping the end pieces over one ear at a time.
Are counsel and defendant present?
Counsel and defendant are both present at the table.
Is the prosecutor present?
I am.
Now would the bailiff please summon the jury?
The bailiff, who was leaning against the bar with his arms folded across his chest, walked over to a door.
The judge has called for the jury!
At the bailiff's call, the 12 men shuffled from the room where they had conducted their deliberations and out onto the main floor of the saloon, to the chairs that had been set out for them in two lines of six. They took their seats, then waited for further instructions from the judge.
Mr. Foreman of the jury, have you reached a verdict?
We have, Judge.
Your Honor.
Say what?
When addressing his honor to the judge, you will say your honor.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I forgot about that. We have reached a verdict, Your Honor.
Please publish the verdict.
Do what?
Tell the court what the jury has found.
Oh, well, sir, Your Honor, we have found this guilty son of a bitch guilty.
So say you all?
So say we all.
Bailiff, escort the defendant to the bench, please.
Pardeen was handcuffed, and he had shackles on his ankles. He shuffled up to stand in front of the judge. Pardeen was not a very large man. In a normal world, any belligerency on the part of a man as small as Pardeen would have been regarded as unimportant, or at least manageable. But this was not an ordinary world, because Pardeen's small stature was offset by the fact that he possessed extraordinary skill with a handgun. But even more important than his skill with a pistol was the diabolical disregard of human life that would allow him to use that skill. It was said of Pardeen that he could kill a human being with no more thought than stepping on a bug. Pardeen's hair was dark and his eyes were brown. One of his eyes was what people called lazy, and it had a tendency to give the illusion that he was looking at two things at once.
Quince Pardine, it is said that you have killed 15 men, and that you may be one of the deadliest gunmen in the West. I could not try you for all those killings. I could only try you for killing Sheriff Logan, and that I have done. You have been tried by a jury of your peers, and you have been found guilty of the crime of murder. Before the court passes sentence, have you anything to say?
I ain't got nothing to say.
Then draw near for sentencing. It is the sentence of this court that you be taken from this place and put in jail long enough to witness one more night pass from this mortal coil. At dawn's light on the morrow, you are to be taken from jail and transported to a place where you will be hanged.
Psst, Your Honor, we can't hang him in the morning. We ain't built no gallows yet.
This court authorizes the use of a tree, a lamppost, a hayloading stanchion, or any other device, fixture, apparatus, contrivance, agent, or means as may be sufficient to suspend Mr. Pardine's carcass above the ground, bringing about the effect of breaking his neck, collapsing his windpipe, and in any and all ways, squeezing the last breath of life from his worthless, vile, and miserable body.
Acting Sheriff Lewis Baker had been napping at his desk when something awakened him. Opening his eyes, he looked around the inside of the sheriff's office. The room was dimly lit by a low-burning kerosene lantern. A breath of wind moved softly through the open window, causing the wanted posters to flutter on the bulletin board. A pot of coffee sat on a small wood-burning stove, filling the room with its rich aroma. The acting sheriff rubbed his eyes, then stood up and stretched. Stepping over to the stove, he used his hat as a heat pad and grabbed the metal handle to pour himself a cup of coffee. Taking a sip of his coffee, he glanced over toward the jail cell. He was surprised to see that Pardine wasn't asleep, but was sitting up on his bunk.
What's the matter, Pardine? Can't sleep?
No.
Well, I don't know as I blame you none. I mean, you're gonna die in about 4 more hours, so you may as well stay awake and enjoy what little time you got left on this earth. Coffee is one of the sweetest pleasures of life, don't you think? But then, life itself is sweet, ain't it?
He laughed again and turned away from the cell. Baker saw someone standing between himself and his desk. He'd not heard the man come in.
Who the hell are you? And what the hell are you doing here? You aren't supposed to be in here.
My name is Corbett. I've come to visit Mr. Pardine.
There ain't no visitors authorized right now.
I've got some sad news for him.
Sad news?
Yeah. Yeah, his brother was killed.
Is that a fact? His brother was killed, was he? Well, now, I wouldn't want to keep our prisoner from getting any sad news. Now, just go ahead and tell Pardine about his brother. The son of a bitch is going to be dead in 4 hours. I'd like to do everything in my power to make his last hours as unpleasant as I can.
Pardine, I hate to be the one to tell you this, but your brother Emerson got himself killed last week.
Who killed him?
A fella by the name of Smoke Jensen. You ever heard of him?
Yeah, I've heard of him. How'd that happen?
It's the damnedest thing you ever saw. Emerson had his gun drawed already, and he was coming back on the hammer when Smoke Jensen drawed his gun and shot him.
You seen this, did you?
Yeah, I seen it.
You must be pretty fast.
He is fast. He's faster than anyone I ever seen.
Yeah, well, I don't care how fast he is. I'm gonna kill him.
You're gonna kill him? And how are you gonna do that? Come sunrise, you're gonna be hanging by your neck.
Give me your gun.
Nodding, Corbett drew his pistol and passed it through the bars to Pardine.
Sheriff, you want to step over here for a moment?
What do you want?
When you get to hell, tell my brother hello for me.
Where are the keys?
They're over there, hanging on a hook behind the desk.
Corbett stepped quickly over to the hook, took down the keys, then returned to unlock the cell door.
Now I've got a couple of horses in the alley.
I appreciate you doing this for me.
Well, your brother was a friend of mine, and I'd like to see the son of a bitch who killed him pay for it. And I figure you're the one who can make him do it.
The two men stepped out into the alley, but instead of going toward the two horses that were tied off in back, Pardeen turned and started walking up the dark alley.
Hey, the horses is over here.
I got somewhere else I'm going to first.
Where you got to go that's so important we can't ride out of here while we have the chance?
The hotel.
Why are we going to the hotel?
You'll see when we get there. That is, if you're coming with me.
Yeah, I'm coming with you.
The two men moved through the dark shadows of the alley until they reached the hotel. Slipping through the front door, they saw the night clerk sleeping on duty. Crossing the darkened lobby, Pardeen turned the registration book around so he could read the entries.
What are you looking for?
Ain't looking. I found it.
Pardeen reached over behind the sleeping clerk and took the key down from a board filled with keys. Recrossing the lobby, Pardeen started up the stairs, with Corbett, still unsure as to what they were doing, climbing the stairs behind him. Reaching the second floor, the two men stopped for just a moment. A couple of candles that were set in wall sconces lit the hallway in a flickering orange light.
He's down this way.
Who is?
The judge.
You're looking for a judge? Why?
He's the son of a bitch that sentenced me to hang. I want to send a message to all the other judges so that if I ever get in this position again, they'll think twice before trying to hang me.
They walked down the carpeted hallway until they found the door Pardeen was looking for. Slowly, he unlocked the door, then pushed it open. Pardeen pulled his gun and pointed it toward the judge. Then, having second thoughts, he put the gun away.
You got a knife?
Yeah, I got a knife.
Let me borrow it.
Corbett pulled his knife from its sheath and handed it to Pardeen. Pardeen raised the knife over the judge, paused a moment, and then pulled it back down.
What is it? What's wrong?
I want the son of a bitch to wake up long enough to know what's happening to him. And see who's doing it.
Corbett nodded. Pardeen reached down to cover the judge's mouth with his hand.
Wake up, you son of a bitch. Bet you never thought you'd see me again, did you? Oh, I guess you're wondering how I got here, huh? Well, I tell you, Judge, I just killed the deputy and broke jail. And now I've come to kill you. What was it you said in court? Something about finding a contrivance or means to suspend me from the ground long enough to break my neck? Well, this here knife is all the contrivance I need, Judge.
Is he dead?
Yeah, he's dead.
Corbett went over to the window and tried to raise it.
What are you doing?
Killing a judge like we'd done. Maybe we ought to go out this way before somebody comes in after us.
Who's gonna come after us, Corbett? I killed the sheriff last week, the deputy and the judge tonight. There ain't nobody left to come after us.
Yeah, there ain't nobody left to come after us.
Smoke was surprised when he saw several head of cattle being pushed onto Sugarloaf. Riding out to see what was going on, he found a small, wiry young man driving the herd. He was riding one horse and leading another. When the young man saw Smoke, he rode toward him, touching the brim of his hat as he reached him. The hat was oversized, with a particularly high crown, almost as if the boy was trying to use it to make up for his small stature.
You Smoke Jensen?
I am.
Mr. Jensen, I heard you was planning on making a big cattle drive up north.
That's right.
Well, these here's your cows that was way down on the south range. I reckon you would have got around in time, but I thought I'd save you the trouble. The name's Sanders. Jules Sanders. I come to join on your drive if you'll have me.
Jules, don't get the wrong idea here. But how old are you?
Tell me how old you want me to be and I'll accommodate you.
That's not what I asked. Now, I'll be honest with you. You don't look a day over 15.
Where do you want me to put these cows?
You say you drove them up here from the South Range?
Yes.
That's 12 miles from here. You brought, how many are there?
63 heads.
You brought 63 head up here from South Range all by yourself?
Yes.
That's a pretty good drive for someone to make all by themselves, no matter how old they might be. You knew we'd be coming down here to get them, didn't you?
Yes, sir. I knew you'd be coming for
them. Then why didn't you just leave them for us?
I wanted to impress you.
Well, I must confess, you did do that.
Mr. Jensen, I need the job.
Jules, this is going to be one difficult drive. It's late in the year, and we've got a long way to go. We'll be gone for some time. How would your mom and dad feel about that?
They're the reason I need to do it. My ma is bringing in washing and such, all the while she's doing for my dad. My dad's all laid up, what the doc calls the cancer. I gotta do something to help out Mr. Jensen.
All right, Jules. I reckon if you can bring this mini head this far all by yourself, then you're man enough to do the job.
Thanks, Mr. Jensen. I can't tell you what this means to me.
One thing, though, Jules.
Yes, sir. Anything.
We're sort of one big family here. I'm Smoke to all the men.
Yes, sir, Mr. Smoke. What do I do with these critters?
Take them out to the North Range. Join them with the others you see there. Then go on down to the house and see Sally.
Sally?
My wife. She's taking care of the business end of this. She'll make sure you're on payroll. By the way, could you use a little advance to send back to your folks?
No, sir. I appreciate the offer, I purely do, but I don't want nothing till I've earned it.
You're a good man, Jules. I don't care how old you are. You're a good man.
Thanks.
When's the last time you ate?
I had me some jerky back this morning.
Well, I know you don't want any money before you earned it, but you wouldn't mind eating with us, would you?
No, sir. I wouldn't mind that. I wouldn't mind that none at all.
When you get back to the house, tell Sally there'll be one more for supper.
Yes, sir. Get along, cows! There's grass for you and vittles for me!
Smoke watched Jules ride off, driving the cattle before him. He didn't really need another man, but there was something about this young man that reminded him of Matt, and there was no way he was going to turn him down. Pearly came riding up shortly after Jules rode off.
Who was that?
Our new man.
I thought we had everyone we needed.
There's always room for one more.
And if you particularly like a person, why, I reckon you'd make room for him even if there weren't none.
I made room for you once, didn't I?
Yes, sir, you done that all right.